Rediscover God's Word, verse by verse, chapter by chapter. This is Real Bible Study with teacher Tom Bradford. Welcome to Torah Class.
In our introduction to the book of Haggai, I explained that significant historical background is needed, as well as the elucidation of special terminology that we find in the original Hebrew to properly examine the book of Haggai and capture what the author intended to impart. Otherwise, we get only a very surface understanding of it, and we can't comprehend, really, why the rebuilding of the temple was of importance, not only to the returning Judeans, even though many didn't realize its full impact, but especially to Yehovah their God, since it was symbolic of the covenant he has made with Israel. Now, we've talked about some of this, but now I want to address another perspective that would have been of paramount interest to the common Judean returnee. It is that the temple was more than a religious symbol. It also reflected a political structure that was the norm, not just for centuries, but for millennia. And it is that a temple was always associated with the legitimization of a king, even of that king's dynasty. We simply do not find a king at any point in biblical history, whether Hebrew or Gentile, who did not support certain gods and claiming they supported him. And so building at least one temple for them to be near to that king. In other words, the gods were assumed to be validating the legitimacy of a king. So a temple was the visible symbol and reminder of their validation. Now, national identity, religious identity, and the head of the political system, the king, were essentially all wrapped up together in one cohesive package. It was not imaginable to the common citizen that all would not be present as a single organic unit. So with that understanding now, let's consider the fate of the returning Judeans. They were in a strange situation. See, when they left as unwilling exiles, it was from a defeated, formerly sovereign Hebrew nation. Now, as they return to the same place, it's no longer a Hebrew nation, but rather a Persian province. Indeed, the enlightened Persian king Darius was encouraging the Judeans to rebuild their temple to worship their God as they pleased, even appointing a Hebrew high priest of the proper lineage as the foundation for a revived and biblically proper priesthood. However, this would all be happening under a governor, not a king. The governor, although an Israelite descended from David, was in no way king, nor was there any thought he would have kingly powers, let alone would he ever evolve in time to become a king. So even though the people would have a strong and virtually independent temple and priesthood, how is this going to work without an Israelite king over them? One element of that organic structure they had been used to was now gone. Now, this would have been a transition of some magnitude for the Judeans, and of course, transitions of most any kind are messy and they're uneven. One of the interesting side effects was that whereas in the Israelite system, the temple and the priesthood were separate from the civil government, with a civil king at its head, truly a separation, if you would, of church and state, so to speak. Now the system Persia set up was that Joshua, the high priest, would co-govern alongside Zerubbabel, the governor, who was essentially a hired Persian civil servant. The civil and the religious mixed, and it overlapped in the most tangible ways. The Hebrew high priest was granted new power no high priest had ever had before. In reality, the balance of governing power now slanted heavily towards Joshua, the high priest, and away from the civil governor, Zerubbabel. Now, the good news was that upon leaving Egypt and at Mount Sinai, the creation of Israel as a separate people and nation, Moses and Aaron formed a somewhat similar kind of government as the Judeans now had, which the Judeans at least could look back to. So they at least had a historical model that they could feel somewhat comfortable with. Moses, like Zerubbabel, was not a king, but Aaron, like Joshua, most certainly was the high priest. Even so, Moses had special privileges within the tabernacle that even Aaron did not. Moses had power heavily slanted towards him that combined some of the religious, but more with the civil. This dynamic would change around 1000 BC when the era of the kings of Israel dawned, after that chaotic, roughly two-century period of the judges of Israel. So there is no evidence that the returning Judeans balked at the increased power bestowed upon Joshua. To put it in more modern terms, the Judeans in Yehud were under more of an actual theocracy upon their return to their homeland than even when Moses ruled, or when the Israelite kings ruled. All in all, this didn't end the Judeans' memory of and longing for the return of the system they admired and wanted most. A king with the civil authority, alongside a temple and priesthood with a religious authority in proper Torah-prescribed balance. Therefore, there would be struggles, anxieties, disagreements over everything religious and civil as they undertook rebuilding the temple and for many centuries into the future. And while this doesn't come into play too much in the books of Haggai and then Zechariah, by the late 1300s BC or so, or rather by the late 300s BC or so, an entirely new religious institution would be established among the Hebrews, the synagogue. And upon the creation of the synagogue, Israel suddenly found itself with two separate religious institutions, the temple with its priesthood, the synagogue with its lay leaders. And this too would create its own tensions and anxieties and struggles. Okay, let's reopen our Bibles to the book of Haggai, chapter 2. Chapter 2. I'm going to start reading at verse 10, and we'll go to the end of the chapter. We're starting at verse 10. (Clears throat) On the 24th day of the ninth month, in the second year of Dariavish, that's Darius, the word of Adonai came through Haggai the prophet. Here is what Adonai Sevaot says. Ask the Kohanim, what the Torah, that's the priests, what the Torah says about this. If someone carries meat that has been set aside as holy in a fold of his cloak, and then he lets his cloak touch bread, stew, wine, olive oil, or any other food, does that food become holy too? The Kohanim answered, no. And then Haggai asked, if someone who is unclean from having had contact with a corpse touches any of these food items, will they become unclean? And the Kohanim, priests, answer, they become unclean. Haggai then said, that is the condition of this people. That is the condition of this nation before me, says Adonai. And that is the condition of everything their hands produce, so that anything they offer there is unclean. Now please, from this day on, keep this in mind. Before you began laying stones on each other to rebuild the temple of Adonai, throughout that whole time, when someone approached a 20-measure pile of grain, he found only 10. And when he came to the wine press to draw 50 measures, there were only 20. I struck you with blasting winds, mildew, and hail on everything your hands produced, but you still wouldn't return to me, says Adonai. So please keep this in mind. From this day on, from the 24th day of the ninth month, from the day the foundation of Adonai's temple was laid, consider this. There's no longer any seed in the barn, is there? And the vine, the fig tree, the pomegranate tree, and olive trees have produced nothing yet, right? However, from this day on, I will bless you. The word of Adonai came a second time to Haggai on the 24th day of the month as follows. Tell Zerubbabel, governor of Judah, I will shake the heavens and the earth. I will overturn the thrones of kingdoms. I will destroy the strength of the kingdoms or of the nations. And I will overturn the chariots and the people riding in them. The horses and their riders will fall, each by the sword of his brother. And when that day comes, says Adonai Zevaot, I will take you, Zerubbabel, my servant, the son of Shealtiel, says Adonai, and wear you like a signet ring, for I have chosen you, says Adonai Zevaot. Now, we more or less ended up last time by discussing two questions that God, through Haggai, directed at the priesthood concerning the matters of holiness and uncleanness, and how or if these could be transferred from one person or object to another. Now, I recommend reviewing last week's lesson to get a more thorough answer. However, the bottom line is that holiness could not be transmitted in any way except by God doing it, while uncleanness could be transmitted in any number of ways, from person to person, person to object, or object to object. And what I want us to notice is that this question was directed to the priests, and without doubt, to the people of that day, that alone was added validation of the increased authority of the priesthood that came even before the temple reconstruction was completed. Now let's address yet another perspective that did not escape the people of that day, but also disputes a common claim of the more liberal-oriented Christian scholars of the late 20th century and now the 21st centuries. And that claim is that the Torah did not actually exist until after the Jews returned from Babylon in the 6th century B.C., Well, we find this in Leviticus chapter 10, starting at verse 8. Adonai said to Aharon, don't drink any wine or other intoxicating liquor, neither you nor your sons with you, when you enter the tent of meeting, so that you will not die. This is to be a permanent regulation through all your generations, so that you will distinguish between the holy and the common, and between the unclean and the clean, and so that you will teach the people of Israel all the laws Adonai has told them through Moses. Now think for a moment on the two questions God set before the priests about holiness and uncleanness. Why would God expect the priests to know the answers to those questions if he had not previously provided a resource to find out? In Leviticus 10, it is commanded that the priests were to be the teachers of the laws given at Mount Sinai. So they had to know the answers in order to properly respond to God's question. See, this is concrete evidence that the Torah existed. In fact, it had to exist long before the Judeans returned to Babylon, because God's instructions about holiness and ritual purity obviously had already been taught. And God expected the priests to know it. And clearly the priests were to be the teaching authority to the rest of the Israelites. Now, if the common Judeans did not recognize that the priests were the Torah experts and knew the answers to religious questions, they wouldn't have shown any regard to what they had to say. But there were very technical questions with answers that would have been mostly known to the priests and not thoroughly understood by the common Hebrews, especially the elders, who all throughout history, right until today, are tasked with being the guardians of historical truth and cultural traditions by passing them along to the next generation. They would have screamed loudly, revolted at the newly revived priesthood if they were just making stuff up that had never before existed. Well, after this matter of holy and unclean were properly explained, then the outcome was applied by Haggai as a metaphor to pronounce the condition of the Judean people. And he says in 2:14, Haggai then said, "This is the condition of this people. That is the condition of this nation before me, Adonai, and that is the condition of everything their hands produce, so that anything they offer there is unclean." God views the Judeans as unclean. Therefore, everything they touch becomes unclean. Therefore, the sacrifices and offerings they bring to Yahweh are unclean. Because obviously those unclean Judeans had touched them. This rendered whatever they offered not acceptable to him. The giving of this oracle, this is the moment when the priests and the people should have become aware that they had definitely put the cart before the horse when they so quickly rebuilt the altar and began sacrificing before they had rebuilt the temple. So much so that without the temple, their uncleanness could not possibly be solved. They would remain unclean in God's eyes, regardless of whatever else they may have thought could resolve the problem. They could obey other parts of the Torah. They could be good family people, honest, hard workers, sincere in other areas of their lives. But an immovable God principle is that sin in one part of your life cascades into other parts, even if you don't recognize it. It's important to remember that sin also brings about a condition of uncleanness upon the sinner. Blood atones for sin, but it does not cleanse a worshiper from the uncleanness that his sin causes. Typically, it takes an immersion in water to be cleansed from the impurity. But if the disobedience that is the source of the sin, which then becomes the cause of the uncleanness, only continues unabated, then water immersion is of no help. And this was the situation for those returning Judeans. Because their ongoing sin was their lack of effort and dedication to rebuild the temple as ordered by God, then they remained in this unclean state. And their unclean state corrupted their sacrifices, which in turn made their sacrifices unacceptable and without effect. And therefore, they not only remained unclean, but also their guilt was not being atoned for. A true catch-22 situation that did have a remedy. It did, but only one. The one Haggai was bringing to the people. Rebuild that temple and do it now. So now the object lesson was presented about the bad circumstances these Judeans had created for themselves. And in verses 15 and 16, we read this. Now please, from this day on, keep this in mind. Before you began laying stones on each other to rebuild the temple of Adonai, throughout that whole time, when someone approached a 20-measure pile of grain, he found only 10. When he came to the wine press to draw 50 measures, there were only 20. See, the idea is that the Judeans are to reflect on what they have been experiencing now that the cause and effect have been carefully explained to them. This is speaking about laying the foundation for the temple and not necessarily building its walls. But of course, the construction project had stopped at rebuilding the foundation, and it had been in a state of suspended animation for the past 15 years. The result? Something those Judeans had not connected with their ignoring rebuilding God's house. When fields were planted, the results were only 50% of what would have been usually expected. It was even worse when it came to the grape harvest. The grapes produced only 40% as much juice as one would have thought. So total deprivation was not the problem. But these paltry yields did bring about hardship and disappointment. And the people were very frustrated about it. So this idea of directly connecting divine blessing with our obedience to the Father is something that is less and less considered in our faith. Sadly, some have tried to misuse or perhaps to reformulate this God principle by establishing something called the prosperity doctrine. Now, interestingly, those who benefit the most from this church doctrine are those pastors that tell their congregations to follow it. At the risk of being branded a heretic, I tell you that the prosperity doctrine has no connection at all to what the Judeans were experiencing. Nor is it a doctrine that any worshiper of God ought to consider. It's false, it's a pure hoax, and it's a deception. This biblical God principle that is highlighted in Haggai is not about a quid pro quo connecting how much you get from God with how much you give. It's about the blessings from heaven that you receive from heartfelt obedience in every facet of your life. But because God is a just God, then it is also about the blessings withheld due to the lack of obedience. Judeans were certainly offering their costly sacrifices, but what they weren't doing was being obedient to build the temple. So they were experiencing a lack. Such doctrine as the prosperity doctrine is only possible for believers to accept because Christianity has, in general, simply watered down or even abolished the concept of obedience to God's laws and commands. In its place, the new obedience directive is mainly focused on giving to the church. Yes, giving is a command, but it's just one of hundreds. So by no means am I demeaning giving or telling you that it's not an obligation placed upon you by the Father. But as Haggai's prophecy is telling us, the lack of obedience in one area of your life will infect and then affect other areas of your life and will also thereby affect whether you receive blessings from above or not. And those blessings may not be monetary, maybe not material. They may amount primarily to inner peace, to good health, to an abundance of children, to your security and your protection, to general sufficiency, and so much more that isn't necessarily reflected in wealth. So says verse 17, God even went so far not only to withhold blessings, but to actually bring about disasters. All of these, scorching heat, green mold, hail. Well, these are all natural disasters. It reminds us that God controls all, including the weather. The language of this verse is very much like we find in the Torah, in the book of Deuteronomy. Listen to what Deuteronomy has to say in Deuteronomy 28, starting at verse 15. But if you refuse to pay attention to what Adonai your God says, and you do not observe and obey all his mitzvot, all his commands and regulations, which I'm giving you today, then all of the following curses will be yours in abundance. Listen to these. A curse on you in the city, a curse on you in the countryside. A curse on your grain basket and kneading bowl. A curse on the fruit of your body, the fruit of your land, and the young of your cattle and flocks. A curse on you when you come in, a curse on you when you go out. Adonai will send on you curses, disasters, frustration, and everything you set out to do, until you are destroyed and quickly perish because of your evil actions and abandoning me. Adonai will bring on you a plague that will stay with you until he has exterminated you from the land you are entering in order to take possession of it. Adonai will strike you down with wasting diseases, fever, inflammation, fiery heat, drought, blasting winds, and mildew. And they will pursue you until you perish. The sky over your head will be brass, the earth under you iron. See, God doesn't make up the consequences for disobedience on the fly any more than he makes up his laws and commands as he goes along. Israel was given God's moral code and commands, were written down, and they were taught to them. They were disobedient to those laws and commands. So the very consequences God promised came about. A word to the wise. despite what you may have heard, this hasn't changed. Being a believer, please hear this. Being a believer comes with greater obligations to obey God's commandments, not lesser. But what is more, says the Lord, even after these disasters, you wouldn't return to me. I want to offer what I confess is speculation, and yet I'm certain this is the case, because it's how we are as human beings and God followers. They didn't return to God because of these troubling events they were suffering, because they didn't believe it was God that would actually bring them about. In fact, the Judeans probably felt very good about themselves, thinking none of these Torah curses would ever apply to them, as they were actually among the small minority of Jews to return from Babylon. And for them, they saw merely the act of returning as a demonstration of their own piety and righteousness. I wonder, in this present era, when the worldwide concern is climate change, however much or little you might personally believe it is anything to be concerned about, does anyone think this might be God's doing? Is it even considered that the church and the synagogue have both pretty much moved in lockstep with the world in moving away from biblical laws and commands and instead into following their own man-made agendas and doctrines that tend to rationalize wicked behaviors of our societies, minimize the severe side of God, because those newer doctrines have become accepted and they are popular. See, as we see cancer, as we see other diseases seeming to be on the rise, spreading at lightning speed, a general unease among people, chaos bursting out without a continent spared, not one. Political systems in convulsion and turmoil, wars, starvation, deprivations increasing. Is this God reacting? And therefore, we need to inquire, what is it that's offending him? My view is that even the God-believing part of the world would either have a wide array of suspected causes, fuzzy, involving mostly our emotions or things that bother us the most, or there would be no coherent idea at all, because each religious faction is sure that nothing they are doing could possibly bring on adverse reaction from God. If the Judeo and Christian world have both essentially abandoned God's laws and commands, trading them in for our own evolving ideals, then how would anyone even know what it is that might be offending him? How would you know? See, this is the conundrum I think our entire world is suffering from today. It's not unlike the conundrum the Judeans were experiencing in Haggai's era. Matter of fact, it's almost exactly the same. So now that God has presented the entire story to his people, to explain why they're experiencing these frustrations, this lack of abundance, here is his encouragement in Haggai 2, starting at verse 18. So, please keep this in mind, he says, from this day on, from the 24th day of the ninth month, from the day the foundation of Adonai's temple was laid, consider this. There's no longer any seed in the barn, is there? And the vine and the fig tree and the pomegranate tree and olive tree have produced nothing yet, have they? However, from this day on, I'll bless you. Clearly, as of the 24th day of the ninth month, the foundation was finally completed. Or very likely something beyond the foundation laying had occurred, such as the gathering of materials to continue the rebuild. So we must try to understand this from the ancient Middle Eastern viewpoint. The reality is, you know, that when cities were destroyed in ancient times, the building foundations were only rarely ever disturbed. In fact, usually when people came back years later to rebuild, the foundations were already there, and they would even reuse the rubble of the former buildings as their building material for the new. A foundation for something like a large temple is nearly indestructible. Even when the Romans sacked Jerusalem in 70 AD, while they knocked down walls to the temple and its retaining walls, they did not disturb the foundation stones. Now, if one has ever been to Jerusalem and been to the so-called Western Wall, the reality that this is mostly the foundation stones you are viewing, and even those are the tip of the iceberg. Under what you can see are even larger stones. The point is, the Romans didn't do anything to the foundation stones because it would have been very difficult to displace them, even with their advanced technology for that era, and would have served no point anyway. More likely, what occurred at this ceremony was a symbolic founding of the new temple. This is not to say that there was an error in the scriptures. Rather, it is how these words traditionally have been interpreted and translated. History and other ancient cultures, as in the Bible, reveal ceremonies, sometimes at various stages of building, for temples and palaces. Whatever was exactly the construction stage this passage is speaking of, it no doubt included visible proof of a change of heart, a firm rededication of the people and the leadership to complete the job. It was apparently apparently enough evidence of their sincerity that God believed them and told them that from this ceremonial date forward, his blessings for them would finally be restored. That said, manna would not start falling from the sky to bolster their food supply. All that would happen is that normal weather patterns would return, beginning with the next seeding and planting. It was going to take time. Time. Another harvest season for each kind of harvest before normal yields would resume. But the people were reassured that all would be well from this point forward, with the hope they had learned their lesson. It was the fruitful harvests that would be the ultimate proof of the return of God's blessings. And I imagine that the people waited with a certain amount of anxiety for the promise to turn into material reality that they so hoped for. Now, verse 20 changes course with a new prophecy. Actually, it's the second prophecy of that same day. Notice also that this is happening on the same day that the symbolic founding of the new temple was being celebrated by the people. and commended by Yehovah. This new prophecy is directed at Zerubbabel, the governor of the province, and it speaks again of the shaking that God is going to do and how this will bring down the governments of the world, as well as the destruction of their militaries. And when in verse 22, Yehovah says that he will overthrow the thrones of kingdoms, the Hebrew verb is afach. It is a word that, when used in the scriptures, denotes God's intervention into the affairs of humanity. It means the divinely caused overthrow of political enemies, of governments. And the last half of this verse says how this overthrow is going to happen. Listen to this. Haggai 2:22. I will overturn the chariots and the people riding in them. The horses and their riders will fall, each by the sword of his brother. Wow. Whereas God overthrew the political entities of Sodom and Gomorrah by cosmic and supernatural means, this verse says this will occur in the same kind of way his own people Israel was overthrown, by divinely caused military defeat. Of course, the question is, when will this happen? And without doubt, this would have been something Guy expected to happen soon and not some too distant time. And the hope for this to happen was especially poignant because of the current political reality of the Holy Land at that time. The Judeans being under the rule of a foreign king, and no doubt, when Haggai spoke this prophecy to the people, it only heightened that hope. However, there are other clues that tell us that this would not be the case. This shaking and overthrowing were going to be not just a future, but also an end times happening. The Hebrews did have an end times theology. But just as in Yeshua's day, when the people then still had this same end times theology and believed they were living in the end times, by the way, it was not to be. The people of Yeshua's day were so certain of it, as were especially his own disciples and later the first generation apostles, that he was forced to speak on the subject. Virtually the entire chapter of Matthew 24 is devoted to this subject. I'm going to quote just a few verses that are the most pertinent for what we're studying today. Matthew 24, starting at verse 5. For many will come in my name, saying, I am the Messiah, and they will lead many astray. You'll hear the noise of wars nearby, the news of wars far off. See to it that you don't become frightened. Such things must happen, but the end is yet to come. For people will fight each other, nations will fight each other, and there will be famines and earthquakes in various parts of the world, and all this is but the beginning of the birth pangs. Then moving on down to Matthew 24 to verse 34. Yes, I tell you that this people will certainly not pass away before all these things happen. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away. But when that day and hour come, no one knows. Not the angels in heaven, not the Son, only the Father. For the Son of Man's coming will be just as it was in the days of Noah. Back then, before the flood, people went on eating and drinking, taking wives, becoming wives, right up till the day Noah entered the ark. And they didn't know what was happening until the flood came and swept them all away. And it will be just like that when the Son of Man comes. So the upshot is, the end times would not arrive in the era of Haggai or, yeah, even Yeshua. But the people held a hope that it would. The reason for this false hope was that they didn't take the prophets as seriously and literally as they should have. And this was because their leaders and teachers didn't either. Amazingly, this seems to be the case once again in our time, but with an ironically different outcome. Jewish and Gentile worshipers of God are having a hard time believing that after so long of a wait, that the end times is right here on our horizon. So, they've ceased discerning the times. God gave us definite signs to tell us when the end times is imminent, and the most conspicuous one is the return of Israel to their homeland as a sovereign nation. This had never before happened, and it was to be a one-time-only event, because that event has happened in 1948 following World War II. So then I have no hesitation to tell you that we are either in the earliest stages of the end times, or we will step over that threshold any day now. The final verse of Haggai is this. When that day comes, says Adonai Zevaot, I will take you, Zerubbabel, my servant, the son of Shealtiel, says Adonai, and wear you like a signet ring. For I have chosen you, says Adonai Zevaot. I kind of think that if any of us heard that from Haggai, we would have judged that Israel was soon to be rescued from Persia, become a sovereign nation again, assume a special place as a world superpower. Because it sure sounds like God is saying that Zerubbabel will be the man in charge when it all happens. This is the seventh time in the book of Haggai that we find Zerubbabel's full name used. And since seven is a sacred number that indicates an ideal number and a divinely supplied completeness, then certainly we are meant to consider Zerubbabel as a very important figure in Israel's history. But is it he that is to be king over a revived Israelite kingdom? No. Rather, God says he will use Zerubbabel as his signet. A signet was usually a ring, sometimes something attached to a chain. And it would be used as that person's signature in official matters. A person who carries Jehovah's signet, therefore, carries Jehovah's authority. Now, this might sound like indeed Zerubbabel is to be that king or for a revived Israelite kingdom. But the fact is that all of Israel's kings were to be God's signets by carrying out God's will. Zerubbabel was never more than a Persian civil servant. So while in one sense he carried God's signet, on the other, this can only be the one who comes upon God's shaking of the world. Clearly, this is a messianic and an end times person that had to be, as was Zerubbabel, a descendant of David. Yeshua has pronounced himself to be that descendant of David. The present Messiah, the future king over God's kingdom. So let us all pray that we are fortified in spirit and in faith and in practical and tangible ways in order to face that great shaking when it comes, because we will not escape it except by our death. That fortification comes from obedience to God. And the code of obedience is the law of Moses. And this concludes our study of the book of Haggai.
For more teachings of real Bible study and to rediscover God's Word with Tom Bradford, visit Torah Class today on the web, streaming TV, or download the Torah Class mobile app.